I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. Jean Marbella of the Baltimore Sun joins us today to talk in part about the series on Baltimore's rent court she wrote last week with her Sun colleague Doug Donovan. Adar Ayer of Baltimore Racial Justice Action and the Associated Black Charities is here as well and with us from New York, where he's covering President Trump's first visit back home since he was inaugurated, Jonathan Lemire, a White House reporter for the Associated Press. The Republican pledge to repeal and replace Obamacare is one step closer to fruition. Democrats think that in its current form, the bill passed by the Congress yesterday has no chance of passing the Senate. They also thought Hillary Clinton would be the president now. Donald Trump thinks that Kim Jong-un is a smart cookie. The president said he'd be honored to meet the North Korean dictator. We'd be honored if you'd stick around for the Midday News Wrap. We'll get underway right after these headlines. All right, Democrats were breaking into song yesterday on the floor of the House of Representatives as the Republicans' seven-year effort to repeal and replace Obamacare finally took a step towards happening. The House sent a revised version of the American Health Care Act to the Senate, where it is expected to be greeted with no small modicum of skepticism. Its prospects aside, President Trump held a celebration in the Rose Garden of the White House, calling it a beautiful bill. It does not differ substantially from the bill that failed to muster enough support in March, but it does dramatically alter or eliminate several key provisions of Obamacare. Democrats in Congress seem to think that this will help them mightily in the 2018 midterm elections. Congress also passed a continuing resolution to keep the government funded through the end of September. The president tweeted, quote, "Our country needs a good shutdown in September to fix mess," referring to the Senate rule that requires 60 votes on such matters. No other president has ever used the word good to modify the word shutdown before. The economy showed signs of improvement this morning. The Labor Department released April jobs numbers, which were up over the previous month. The unemployment for white people and Asian Americans is at a 10-year low. African Americans are stuck at rates that are twice that of whites. On the international front, the president alternately puzzled and horrified observers with laudatory comments about Kim Jong-un of North Korea and Rodrigo Duterte of the Philippines. And here at home, Mayor Catherine Pugh has been lauded for convincing a highly respected Fourth Circuit Court judge, Andre Davis, to leave the bench and become the city's next solicitor. And the Baltimore Sun explored the rent court system in a multi-part investigative series. I'm Tom Hall, and one of the authors of that series, Jean Marbella, joins us this afternoon for the Midday News Wrap. She has been a writer and editor at the Sun for 30 years. She's currently on the Sun's investigative and enterprise team. She co-wrote the rent court series with the Sun's Doug Donovan. She has been a feature writer, a national correspondent, and a columnist covering everything from city politics to the Olympics and 9/11. Jean, welcome back. Good to see you.
It's great to be here.
And Adar Ayer joins us as well. She's a poet, an artist, and an anti-racism facilitator with Baltimore Racial Justice Action. She's also the program director at Associated Black Charities. Always a pleasure, ma'am. Good to see you.
And I am so glad to be here. Thank you.
And we are pleased to be joined on the phone from New York by Jonathan Lemire. He's formerly a reporter at the New York Daily News, and currently he covers the White House for the Associated Press. Jonathan, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
So you are welcome to join us out there in radio land or podcast land. I guess it's a little late to join us if you're in podcast land. But if you are in radio land and you'd like to be part of our conversation, 410-662-8780 is our number. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Jonathan, you are in New York because the president returned to Manhattan for the first time since he was inaugurated back in January. What do New Yorkers think about all that?
I think it's safe to say they weren't that excited to see him. President Trump, of course, is a native New Yorker. He was born in Queens, pushed his father's real estate company into Manhattan, where he turned it into sort of a national empire. And he is a known creature of habit and homebody to the point where, you know, he has lived in the penthouse of Trump Tower since the 1980s. And during the campaign, which I helped cover, if we were basically anywhere east of Denver, he'd fly home every night back to Trump Tower, which led to a lot of speculation that when he took office, he would continue to do that. That has not been the case, of course. He certainly has left Washington on plenty of weekends, but he has been heading down to Mar-a-Lago, his estate in Florida. Now that that is closing for the season, though, we do anticipate him coming north, although we think he will be at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, which is where he is right now. But he was in the city for a few hours last night. He was met with some protests. The crowds were not gigantic. They were, certainly don't compare to those that we saw soon after the inauguration or at the airports when the first travel ban came down. But they were protesters who lined the West Side Highway and saluted, shall we say, the presidential motorcade as it headed north to the Intrepid. But it was sort of a triumphant homecoming for the president, who, you know, is deeply unpopular here. I believe he received about 18% of the vote in New York in November. But he was able to come here on the heels of a win, of getting the health care bill passed the House. And he was able to hold a meeting with the Australian Prime Minister and celebrate that alliance and leave town on a high note.
He did arrive in New York a little later than originally scheduled because he stuck around Washington to pat himself and congressional Republicans on the back about the health care bill. How did the meeting with Prime Minister Turnbull go from Australia?
Well, it was certainly shorter than expected, as you said. It was originally supposed to last most of the afternoon for an official bilateral meeting. It ended up being a rather quick chat before the event at the Intrepid, which is an aircraft carrier docked here on the Hudson River, decommissioned from World War II. And the event last night was the 75th anniversary of the Battle of the Coral Sea, which is seen as a rather pivotal naval battle in the Pacific War during the World War II. That was a battle in which the American and Australian forces teamed up. So he did meet with Prime Minister Turnbull beforehand. They downplayed talk of tension from their previous call. You might remember that they spoke in February, and it was described afterwards as a rather contentious exchange. The president did acknowledge that it got a little heated, but he said that they are allies. He pledged their friendship and that the alliance would continue.
Here's a part of what the president said in his remarks last night.
Premiums are going to come down very substantially. The deductibles are going to come down. It's going to be fantastic health care. Right now, Obamacare is failing. We have a failing health care. I shouldn't say this to our great gentleman and my friend from Australia, because you have better health care than we do. But we're going to have great health care very soon.
So, Gene Marbella, the president commending Australia on the better health care than we have in the United States. Of course, they have government-funded health care for all, which is the most anathema idea
to what we have
and also to what Republicans support. They have single-payer coverage, essentially, in Australia. So, Lord knows what he meant by that. Lord knows what he means by a lot of things that he says. The health care bill that was passed by the Congress yesterday was not yet scored by the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office. Do you recall in your experience another time when bills have been rushed through like this without people really knowing, number one, exactly what's in them, or number two, exactly what it will cost?
Yeah, I feel like we could say this every week. It seems unprecedented to me how this got pushed through. As you mentioned, there was no congressional budget analysis of this. And it's essentially the bill that was soundly defeated in March. And like a zombie, it came back in, as some people would say, in a worse form. And yet somehow it got railroaded through the House.
And Adar Ayer, they did find the votes. They didn't have the votes in March, but they found them one way or the other. One way evidently was to sweeten the pot for people with pre-existing conditions by a factor of about $8 billion. There are people who say that that is not going to be nearly sufficient enough to actually cover these people who are pretty sick to begin with. This really does come down to a view of healthcare, one of which says the market will take care of it, and the other of which says the government needs to greatly influence that market in order to make it actually work for everybody.
You know, I agree with you that the bill came back like a zombie and in worse form. The 8 $1 million, $1 billion, is supposed to cover, I think, 166,000 people out of the millions that need it. So basically, this bill was an ego. It was an ego bill, and it was an ego vote. It was pure politics. And I just wonder how long it will take for the American people to start feeling the effects of it and to figure out that we have all been bamboozled by the bill. The states can opt out of providing coverage for pre-existing, and that is something that it has gotten some coverage. I just am not sure. It just boggles my mind why that has not been given more surface, more conversation, because that is a key component of the bill, and that's the thing that is going to impact millions and millions of lives.
And Jonathan Lemire, I think folks have talked a fair amount about the fact that Medicaid, for example, the expansion to Medicaid has been cut by some estimates of about $840 billion. In terms of the politics of this, it does now go to the Senate. What do you think the mood in the Senate is as they receive this particular piece of legislation?
Well, first, returning to an earlier point, there's no question that the White House wanted to win. It was sort of a remarkably, in some ways, premature celebration in the Rose Garden yesterday, but they were desperate for those optics of the president with the cheering lawmakers behind him having a celebratory moment for a West Wing that felt like it needed a victory, that has had an uneven first 100 days, shall we say. Though in the last week has strung together a few things, the passing of the spending bill, the successful meeting last night in Australia, that they are hoping to build some momentum from. In terms of where this goes in the Senate, and the Senate has already sent signals that they are going to perhaps start their own bill and draft their own measure, which of course will then require a reconciliation process, and and we'll see where it goes. This is still at very early stages. There's no question that it would be a rush to say that this is going to be the law. There are plenty of places where this could fall apart down the road, but Senate Majority Leader McConnell is certainly skilled at this, and we will see where it goes in the coming days. We do expect that the White House will lean on the Senate, but there are some personalities in there, even on the Republican side, that the president has not always gone along with, former campaign rivals, others who, plenty of folks, senators in there who never backed his campaign. The West Wing may find it a little harder sledding in the Senate than it did in the House.
And Gene Marbella, it's interesting, the coalition of groups who are opposed to this bill, include people who run hospitals, health insurers themselves, doctors, people who represent seniors, the AARP. But I guess one group of folks that potentially does benefit from this is younger, is the younger cohort. And, of course, the idea of Obamacare, to a certain extent, was to tax people on the higher income, higher part of the income spectrum, and to tax younger people to help pay for everybody. The taxes have been taken off in large measure of those high income earners, and costs putatively will go down for younger people as they try to insure themselves. But it is interesting how many people think that this particular approach, with pools of pre-existing conditions and that sort of thing, is not the right way to go.
Right. It really hurts the most vulnerable. It hurts the people who are cancer patients, who are old, who are low income, who have pre-existing conditions. And it helps the wealthy whose income has been skyrocketing while everyone else's wages have been stagnating. And the thing you don't want to do is give young people a reason not to have health insurance, because they're what support the sicker people. I know when I was younger, I never used my health care. I was paying premiums right and left, and people don't remember, but premiums went up before Obamacare. People act like they're only going up because Obamacare is now in place. But all that time I was paying premiums and not using it, other people were benefiting. And now that I'm of the age when I will probably need my health care more, suddenly it may not be there.
And Adar, before we take a break, I mean, insurers now do have, if this bill were to pass in its present form in the Senate, options to step away from covering things like mental illness or addiction, ambulance rides. I mean, you could find yourself dead broke if you're in a car accident, if you have certain kinds of coverages that would be allowed under this bill.
Not only dead broke, but these younger people have families. They have elders. They have people who are going to be depending on them to subsidize the cost of their prescriptions, their medical bills. So I think that this bill is very short-sighted. Well, to everybody except for the upper income who will get the benefit, the full benefit of the bill. And in addition to being an ego bill, that is the audience that was targeted to benefit from this bill. Let's be very clear.
And Jonathan Lemire, before we take a break, this does represent a pretty substantial win for the Republicans. This is a sort of first demonstration of their capacity to govern. They were able to bring together various parts of the Republican conference, from the Tuesday group to the Freedom Caucus, moderates to people much further on the right. You got to give them credit for that.
That is right. I mean, they just barely did, but they did. And this is obviously the pledge to repeal and replace Obamacare is one that they have made on a virtually a daily basis for the last 7 years. And the fact that they couldn't in March was humiliating for the White House, for Speaker Ryan, for the party in itself. And they were able to make a few compromises, they make a deal, and they at least got the ball this far down the field. But they have a ways to go.
It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall, joined today by Jean Marbella of the Baltimore Sun, A. Adar Ayira of Associated Black Charities, and on the line with us from New York, Jonathan Lemire. He's a White House reporter for the Associated Press. When we come back from a break, you are welcome to join us here on Midday and the News Wrap. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. Follow us on Twitter @Midday. Tom Hall. Before we take that little break, today at 1 o'clock, right after our show, as a matter of fact, at the Delaney Valley Memorial Gardens in Timonium, Prince George's County firefighter and paramedic Lieutenant John Olmschneider will be honored in the 32nd annual Fallen Heroes Day, which honors members of the public safety community. Lieutenant Olmschneider died in the line of duty on April 15, 2016. We offer our condolences to his family and his colleagues. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
It wasn't a perfect campaign. There is no such thing. But I was on the way to winning until the combination of Jim Comey's letter on October 28th and Russian WikiLeaks raised doubts in the minds of people who were inclined to vote for me but got scared off. We overcame a lot in the campaign. We overcame an enormous barrage of negativity, of false equivalency, and so much else. But as Nate Silver, who doesn't work for me, he's an independent analyst, but one considered to be very reliable, has concluded, if the election had been on October 27th, I'd be your president.
Hillary Clinton speaking earlier this week at the Women to Women International Conference in New York City. By the way, coming up Monday here on Midday, my guests will be Amy Parnes and Jonathan Allen. They are veteran reporters who've written a book about the 2016 presidential contest. It's called Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. So you can imagine with a title like that for a book what their perspective is. If you've just joined us today, it's the Midday News Wrap. Adar Ayira of Associated Black Charities is here in the studio, along with Jean Marbella of the Baltimore Sun, and on the line from New York, Jonathan Lemire, a White House reporter for the Associated Press. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can follow us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. You can send us an email, midday@wipr.org, or give us a buzz, 410-662-8780. So, Jonathan Lemire, FBI Director James Comey testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Monday of this week. he had some things to say and some things pointedly he chose not to say. How do you think that was received on both sides of the aisle?
It was a pretty remarkable display for an FBI director who has become a sort of very central figure in a very political moment. He, of course, said that he, I believe the quote was, that he was mildly nauseous to think that the FBI's decision to reveal that it was looking into what appeared to be a new batch of Hillary Clinton emails about 10 days or so before the election may have played a role in deciding the election. Democrats, of course, think it played a significant role. You just heard the soundbite from Secretary Clinton, who did, to be fair, acknowledge some of her campaign's own shortcomings in contributing to her loss. But there's no question that she has blamed Russian hacking and the WikiLeaks and, of course, the Comey letter as a driving force behind her defeat. The Republicans, of course, on the other side of the aisle, think this is nonsense, that they believe that the president defeated her fair and square. I think that they obviously they bristle every time the subject of Russian hacking comes up, because that seems in their mind to suggest the idea of some illegitimacy of the president's victory. And I was struck that I think around the same time that Director Comey was testifying, Press Secretary Sean Spicer was in the White House briefing room and said that he found it sad that people were still talking about the election, and that sort of elicited a chuckle from some people, because the president himself, of course, talks about the election on a near daily basis and loves to recount his victory. He goes through a TikTok of election night in the states in which order they were called, and in fact, he did a series of interviews to mark his 100 days in office a week or so ago, and was handing out maps of his electoral college victory to reporters who were talking to him.
Yeah, maybe Mr. Spicer, Adara, needs to just, you know, follow at real Donald Trump to find out what the president has to say about
right.
the election, because he does have a lot to say about it. You know, it's interesting when it comes to Secretary Clinton and who bears responsibility for her loss. This whole notion of personal responsibility came up even in the healthcare debate. People talk about, you know, the ramifications or the manifestations of people living their lives in particular ways, or in Mrs. Clinton's case, running her campaign in a particular way.
Absolutely. You know, this through the presidential campaign and through the postmortem of the presidential campaign and in the healthcare bill, there is always this subtext of deserving and undeserving. So, for instance, there was a state representative from, I think, Alabama, Mo Brooks, I think his name is, who right. talked about, oh, if you live your life in the right way, then you deserve to pay less. And it was very clear that
if you live your life the right way, you won't get sick.
Right. You
Therefore,
won't get sick.
You won't need the healthcare system. So you should
absolutely.
Pay less.
And so if you don't, then of course you do. Now that leaves out all of the people who get cancer, the little children who get sick. What have they done? But there is a refrain there. When there is a postmortem of the campaign and we talk about, oh, we have to give voice to the voiceless, the working class, we're talking about white working class who have voice. And there is this unspoken meta conversation that somehow the Democratic Party is a party of special interest, i.e. people who are not white. But there and that people who voted for Trump, it wasn't race-based, but it was that they had no voice in the Democratic Party. I mean, this is the meta conversation narrative that our country, that media, that Hillary herself continues to talk about, but nobody raises that to the surface. And there is an issue when you have 58% of white voters who voted for Donald Trump, and when he got nowhere near the percentages from any other community but that one.
And Jean Marbella, Secretary Clinton is writing a book. She alluded to it several times in her conversation with Christiane Amanpour from CNN at the Women to Women conference. She indicates that it will be in part at least a sort of mea culpa for the mistakes she made. She's also said that she's willing to put herself forward as one of the leaders of the resistance. It's interesting, an interesting moment for the Democratic Party and for Democrats in the House and Senate in particular, as they continue to to search for the proper way to negotiate the era of Trump.
Right. And there is a substantial sector of the Democratic Party that would rather Hillary just go away. You know, there are the Bernie people, the people who still say that Bernie would have won, and the party needs to come up with the next generation. You know, and just the fact that Hillary is out there, there's already mutterings, oh, will she run again? And that's countered immediately by people saying, dear God, no. So it's it'll be interesting to see what her role is. Does she become an elder statesman? What's Obama's role in the future? It's a very interesting time.
And Jonathan Lemire, the jobs report released by the Labor Department today showed that in April, the economy added 211,000 jobs. That's a little more than folks thought perhaps would be added. It's certainly more than were added in March. They attributed the dip in March to weather conditions and various other sort of subtleties in the economic landscape. Unemployment rate nationally down to 4.4%. That's the lowest it's been in a long, long time. Will the Trump administration get a chance to embrace this as a victory as well?
I'm certain they will. They have not yet. The White House has not issued a statement yet, but we expect that will probably happen at the briefing in a short time. Frankly, it comes as a little bit of a surprise. The president hasn't tweeted about it. He is someone who in the past has pointed to government statistics or like jobs reports, when they're favorable. He points to them as evidence that things are going well under Trump administration, the confidence is up and things like that. He also, of course, when things are bad, has suggested that the stats are unreliable. So, yes, I do think that this will be added to the narrative that they are they're having a little bit of a winning streak here.
And again, they sort of pick and choose the stats that they like to do. Sometimes the president has also said that the Labor Department statistics are baked and wrong. And you know, so we'll just have to see. And Adar Ayira, to your point that you just made, among white people, the unemployment rate is 3.8%. It's even lower among Asian Americans, 3.2%. It's double that for African Americans and at 5.2% for Hispanics. So when we talk about the unemployment rate, it's really just for a certain sector of the white economy.
Exactly. And our narrative is always focused on what is happening in the white economy. And the reality is that for African Americans, the unemployment rate has more or less remained steady for the past 30 or more years.
Yeah, so it hasn't gotten better by any means. So
right. And in fact, for certain age demographics, it has gotten worse.
And Jonathan Lemire, when it comes to race and criminal justice, the Justice Department announced this week that they will not charge the officers in Baton Rouge who shot Alton Sterling to death. People saw that video, and having seen that video, it's very difficult for lots of people to say, how can there not be a case here? But the Justice Department has decided that there isn't a case there. Is this indicative of the new sheriff in town, literally, with Jeff Sessions now running the Justice Department?
It's possible. The Attorney General has certainly said that he feels that there perhaps is too much oversight of local police departments and thinks that that is a waste of perhaps time and resources. And it also goes to show just how difficult it can be to obtain an indictment of a police officer involved in one of these instances, whether that's in Baton Rouge or, you know, here in New York with the Eric Garner case a few years ago. Certainly, you know, you have experience there in Baltimore, too. It is something that is, I think, bedeviling the justice system, obviously, and at least for now, this attorney general has not suggested that it would be a priority.
And Gene Marbella, in Balch Springs, Texas, a young kid who's, you know, been consistently described as an athlete and honor student. People go to great pains to say, you know, this was not a punk. This was a really sweet young boy, 15 years old, Jordan Edwards, shot with a rifle by a police officer when his brother, who was driving the car in which Jordan was sitting in the passenger seat in the front, was driving away from police officers. The initial comment by the police department in Balch Springs was that the car was backing towards the officer, and that's why he shot. In fact, the video camera that the officer was wearing shows that exactly the opposite was happening. The car was going away from the officer. Where do you think this sits in this horrible panoply of incidences like this when young black mostly boys, are being literally targeted by law enforcement?
Well, it shows the importance, I think, of a department, a federal Department of Justice, doing oversight. It's very hard for a local police department to investigate itself and have whatever the results are accepted. So that is always why, you know, cities have turned to the Department of Justice to be the independent voice who comes into town and reviews the situation. And we saw what happened.
As they're doing here in Baltimore.
Right. And they issued a 160-some page report that documented years and years of, you know, black people being jumped on the street by these, you know, by officers, you know, shaken down, you know, rape victims being ignored. You know, they found a pattern of injustice. And if the DOJ now is backing away from that oversight role, what happens?
And Adar Ayira, we've just finished here on Midday about a half a dozen shows in which we reflected on the two-year anniversary of the death of Freddie Gray that sparked the uprising in April of 2015. We talked to everybody from activists to the police commissioner. With the developments with Jordan Edwards' death in Texas, or the decision by the Justice Department not to prosecute the officers in the death of Alton Sterling, where does that, and given our experience here in Baltimore, six officers indicted, none convicted, where in your mind does that leave this so-called conversation about race?
Listen, if we can't even get convictions when there is evidence there, when there are video online where people can see what's happening, when we are told, ignore what you see, you know, it's your lying eyes, but these officers are not guilty. And at the same time, when we also ask the question, oh, what can we do about crime? We need more jails. We need more police presence on the street. It's a very clear message that is being given out, and that is that black lives do not matter.
Got to take a break. Want to mention that John in Baltimore called. He couldn't stay on the line, but he makes the point that Hillary Clinton's unlikable poll numbers were very high before the letter by Jim Comey, before the WikiLeaks dribbling out of emails from John Podesta, etc. As I said, we are going to talk more about that when we talk to two authors who've written about the Hillary Clinton campaign in on Monday, when they're here for Midday. That's called Shattered: Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. Jean Marbella is part of the investigative and enterprise team at the Baltimore Sun. Adar Ayira is the program manager at Associated Black Charities and a facilitator at Baltimore Racial Justice Action. Jonathan Lemire has joined us from New York. He's a White House correspondent for the Associated Press. And Jonathan, we know you've got eggs to lay and places to go, so we're going to let you go. And I appreciate your time this afternoon. Thanks so much.
Happy to do it.
You are welcome to join us when we come back from a break. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. If you want to follow us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. This is what they say on Saturday night, every Saturday night. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. If you are just joining us for this week's edition of the News Wrap, we are joined here in Studio A by Jean Marbella, who, along with Doug Donovan, recently published a series in the Baltimore Sun about Baltimore's rent court. We're going to talk a little bit about that. And Adar Ayira is here as well. She's with the Baltimore Racial Justice Action and Associated Black Charities. If you'd like to join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Jean, you and Doug Donovan spent a better part of a year looking into rent court. What'd you find?
Well, we did the first computer analysis of about 5-6 years worth of rent court data just to see what the trends were. And overall, we found rent court, which Baltimore should be quite proud of its rent court. It was the first in the nation to actually have a strictly housing-only court to adjudicate problems with the conditions of housing. You know, there was a group of very progressive, you know, social workers, city officials who became appalled by the living conditions in Baltimore's slums and decided to give tenants their own court, basically. But what we found is instead of supporting tenants who are living in substandard housing, we found that the court generally favors landlords. And most of, you know, judges are supposed to open an escrow account for tenants who have valid housing complaints against their landlord who hasn't repaired them. And in the cases where there were demonstrable and serious housing code violations, they only opened an escrow account in half the time. The other time, they just let the landlord fix it whenever, or who knows what happened to some of those cases. And then in the end of these cases, you know, people were living with rodent infestations, with leaking roofs, without heat in the winter. At the end of this process, we found that most of the rent money that the tenants paid was returned to the landlord. So the landlords generally are not being held as accountable for the conditions of rental housing in Baltimore as they should be or as the court intended. And it's a big issue in Baltimore because compared to other cities and compared to the region, we have a much higher percentage of renters than homeowners.
And Adar Ayira, if you were a Vegas bookie or a London odds caller, landlords win about 90% of the cases in Baltimore rent courts. You would be reluctant, shall we say, to bet against the landlords. I was talking to Commissioner Kevin Davis, the commissioner of the Baltimore City Police Department, a couple of days ago, and a caller asked, you know, what is it the thing? What's the thing that divides that young kid who turns out okay and doesn't have brushes with the law, and that other kid who goes down the wrong path and ends up, you know, in the criminal justice system? And one of the first things that the commissioner mentioned was, you know, the kid's living conditions. You know, and if we have children in our city living in substandard housing, whether it's owned by the city, you know, whether it's the Gilmore Homes or whether they're renting on the open market, this has ramifications that go way past whether or not, you know, somebody's got roaches and mice running around their apartment.
You know, it goes to a psychological trauma, which we really do not talk about. And it's not just the living conditions, it is also the conditions of that community. It is not having any businesses there, businesses that provide opportunity for first jobs. It is not having schools there that are places of safety, not places that look like prisons. It is so many other things. But you know what it is, Tom? It is about their sense of their own value and worth, what society thinks of them, what society believes about them. And they know that they're not being invested in. And that is a psychological blow. Oftentimes we look at the parents and think, well, what are they doing? Well, they're trying to hold it together. That's what they're trying to do with oftentimes minimal support because of our assumptions, because of our biases, and because of our inability to put ourselves into their shoes to actually see what is going on in their lives.
Let's go to the phones. Barbara in Baltimore, welcome to the Midday News Wrap with Jean Marbella and Adar Ayira.
Thank you. I found your articles in the paper, very interesting, discouraging, and timely. I have a friend who is scheduled to go to rent court next Monday to put rent in escrow, and going with her, I have found the process certainly intimidating. And I had some questions whether in your study, did you look at housing other than low-cost housing, you know, other open-market housing? Because, you know, the case in my friend's case involves not, it's catering to a lot of Hopkins students, and many of them feel that they are not getting proper service, but since many of them are international students, where English is not their primary language, this process is further compounded when they don't have friends and family to support them.
Right.
And, you know, even the idea of my friend who is able to communicate quite well with me, she feels that she can comprehend better in any situation, whether it's a doctor appointment, if she has a friend or family with her, that she's calmer and can comprehend and speak more clearly.
Right.
And yet in rent court, it's rent or escrow court, it sounds like she has to do it on her own if she doesn't have an attorney.
Yes.
Despite the fact that having a friendly person with her may increase her comprehension and ability to articulate her case.
Well, thanks for your call, Barbara.
That's one of the biggest problems that we found, that close to 90% of landlords show up either with an attorney or with a property manager who will argue the case for them. And nearly the same percentage of tenants show up without any representation. And it is very intimidating. Things move fast. And if you don't know how to advocate for yourself, you're just kind of, you know, the events sort of overwhelm you. There are free lawyers available, but for some reason, tenants just don't avail themselves of it. I think they think, oh, this is straightforward. I paid my rent. I should get a livable apartment. So that's one of the solutions that the judiciary is looking at. They're thinking of starting a navigator program, which would be someone who's not a lawyer, but someone who's conversant in the rent court procedures, who would be by your side and help you with the paperwork and help you prepare your defense. And there's also a program that's going to start that would increase the number of free lawyers that are available. Currently, you literally can count on one hand the number of lawyers available. They're from Maryland Legal Aid, Public Justice Center, or Green and Healthy Homes Initiative, the lead paint organization.
The Attorney General, Brian Frosch, and the mayor, Mayor Pugh, have both talked about, you know, increasing access to representation, as you say, if not with an attorney, but then with somebody who at least knows the game.
Yes, yeah. And Delegate Sandy Rosenberg of Baltimore had introduced legislation that would have proposed some of these solutions, but it died in committee.
Let's go to another call. Gwen in Baltimore, thanks for your call to the Midday News Wrap. Welcome.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. You're on the air.
Okay, thank you very much. It was a really important, wonderful article. And with 150,000 cases and lead poisoning, you know, with now the lower levels, we know no safe level. I wonder your thoughts about this being an opportunity for us to discover who the children are, where the houses are, where the domiciles are that are falling under the radar, the lowest income, the people with the least rights. And you know, from the ABLE Foundation, least up to date with their lead certification, it's so disappointing that the Bill 1487 didn't get passed. That would have required the judges to make sure that lead compliance was intact. And that seems like with 150,000 cases, this is a place where we could really spot where these children are getting exposed and really do great preventive work. And what are your thoughts about how to do that now with the 1487 dying in the Senate?
Thanks for the call, Gwen.
Well, I think Sandy Rosenberg is planning on reintroducing it next session. And he plans to have it introduced in the Senate as well as the House so that it can get a fuller airing than it did this time around. And also, as Tom had mentioned, Mayor Pugh has come out saying that we really do need to focus on this. She had told us that, oh, now that I've worked out the consent decree with the Department of Justice, now that we've solved the funding crisis with education, housing is next on her agenda, is something she really wants to delve into.
And Adar Ayira, it's interesting to me that Mayor Pugh won the primary, making her the Democratic nominee for mayor, which all but sort of guaranteed her election as mayor the following November. But she won that primary a year ago in April. She won the election in November, and throughout the primary, she and almost everybody else running for mayor said they were definitely going to get rid of Paul Graziano as the head of housing here in Baltimore. So it was no surprise that Mr. Graziano lost his job, but they still haven't found anybody to replace him. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not here representing Associated Black Charities. You're here as an independent political observer. But with the folks that ABC works with, is there a sense that the Pugh administration has, you know, taken the bull by the horns? Is there a sense that there's energy and that there's a momentum going? Because it seems surprising to some that something like housing, which is a no-brainer, we need a new housing commissioner, we haven't been able to find one yet.
Mm-hmm. So I have absolutely nothing to offer on that. And this is why. There are a lot of things confronting the city. You know, we have, or I don't have, as an observer, I don't have insight into her priorities. But I will say this, Tom, that we know those areas of the city where lead poisoning is an issue. This is not new information. We know the impact of lead poisoning on our citizens. That is not new information. So this is not this doesn't only impact low-income people. This is a public crisis. And if we were talking about Roland Park, if we were talking about any other areas of the city other than those that we're talking, I wonder whether or what would be changed in terms of appointments, in terms of urgency, in terms of everything. And this is, you know, in our city, this is in our state policy and legislation, and this is nationally.
Erica Alston Buck, who runs the Kids Safe Zone in Sandtown Winchester, was on the show last week, and she speculated that, you know, with the murder rate in Baltimore, the homicide rate being the second worst rate in the country, if 111 white people had been shot between mm-hmm. January 1st and May 5th, we might be having a very different conversation, Jean Marbella.
Yeah, and I think we've cut the murder rate in the past. So it's been demonstrated that there are solutions. Mm-hmm. And I just think it takes a lot more creativity, a lot more thinking, a lot more planning. You know, if you can't solve this crime problem, you're not going to solve anything else in Baltimore.
And I would say that what we need are jobs. People need opportunity. That's what people need. And that's what we need to offer.
And one job that Judge Andre Davis is going to take in October, again, it takes us several months for this to happen, but in October he's going to leave the Fourth Circuit bench. He's a highly respected jurist, and he's going to become the city's new solicitor. So kudos to Judge Davis and to the mayor for convincing him to do that. And kudos to you, Jean Marbella, and Adar Ayira for joining us today once again for the News Wrap. Very much appreciate it, and have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Jean Marbella has been a reporter, a columnist, and an editor at the Baltimore Sun for 30 years. She's currently on the Sun's investigative and enterprise team. We'll have a link to her recent series on Baltimore's rent court, which she co-wrote with the Sun's Doug Donovan, on our website, WIPR.org/midday. And Adar Ayira, she's a poet, an artist, and an anti-racism facilitator with Baltimore Racial Justice Action. She's also the program director at Associated Black Charities. Before we go, this shout out to Selma Levi, who has been the children's librarian at the Enoch Pratt Central Library for almost 39 years. She retired on Monday, and we wish her all the best. Her legions of fans will remember her as a legendary storyteller and for her Rhyme of the Month segments. Over the years, people have appreciated her ability to remember what each child likes and to recommend the perfect book for every one of her young charges. Miss Levi, we thank you for your service. Coming up midday on Monday, a deep look inside the historic and unprecedented Hillary Clinton campaign for president, with two reporters who embedded with that campaign throughout its duration. Jonathan Allen is a columnist at Roll Call. Amy Parnes is a senior White House correspondent for The Hill. They'll join me to talk about their new book, Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. That's coming up Monday on Midday. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Charlie Hines provides production assistance. Thanks for listening. I look forward to being with you next week. Have a great weekend.